Hey everybody, welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is producer, engineer, and mixer, Wynn Davis. But first, I want to talk about the new music business and what we actually sell in it. For a long time, most artists thought that their music was their product, and to some degree it was, because you'd buy, first of all, vinyl records, you'd buy CDs, you'd buy cassettes. Obviously, that's all changed to digital now, and music product is somewhat devalued. Now, that said, we're kind of changing our business model. Most artists now know that what they're really selling is experiences. So, for instance, if you go to Las Vegas and you want to go see Britney Spears, you can buy a ticket to see Britney. That's part of the experience. But if you want, there are a whole array of VIP packages that you can spend thousands of dollars to either meet her personally, go backstage, watch from the side of the stage, come out into the show while she's doing it, all sorts of things, and you pay for those experiences. And that's part of the new music business. Even something as simple for a band as a meet and greet before or after a show, that's an experience, and that's something that fans will pay for. And if they're not paying for it in money, they're paying for it in social currency. They're paying for it in an increase of their love for the act. But that being said, we can make money off of experiences. And the latest iteration of that is English artist PJ Harvey selling the sessions to her next record. What that means is that her fans can now purchase the ability to watch her recording her next album. And this was actually so successful that she broke her server. She sold out 3,000 tickets at about $22 a piece. And if you do the math, that's about $66,000, which these days can buy a pretty good chunk of studio time. The tickets were limited to 4 per household, and there's basically 2 different windows during the session day that you can sign up for. So you get the ability to watch her record her album. And it'll be interesting to see what the fan reactions are, because there are certain times, of course, that can be really exciting, be really cool watching creation. And as we all know, it can be as slow as watching paint dry sometimes. So I'm just wondering what's going to happen the first time her fans have to watch an editor do a vocal comp, or wait until something gets fixed because the microphone isn't working on the drums or it's distorting or something like that. So that should be pretty interesting to see what happens. That being said, experiences are the way to go. And you find this across just about all walks of life these days. People are selling experiences. Brands are selling experiences because you can make more money from them. So just remember that as you go about your music life, because our products and our product offerings are definitely changing. The next thing I want to talk about is something that I saw over on the Hook Theory site. That's hooktheory.com. And they did a study of 1,300 popular songs to find out what were the most popular keys. Being a guitar player and thinking that the rest of the world plays guitar as well, I would have thought that the most popular keys would have been E or A. But in fact, what they found was C, G, and E flat, followed by F, D, and here we go, A and E, D flat, B flat, A flat, B, and F sharp, and all of the relative minors for those particular keys as well. So C, G, and E flat were the most popular keys found in 1,300 hit songs. The next thing they did is they wanted to find out what were the most popular chords. So basically, everything transposed to C, so there's a common reference point. The most popular chords were G, F, C, A minor, D minor, E minor, E, D, B flat, and A. Now again, I would have thought it would have been E and A, but wouldn't have thought that G, F, and C, C maybe, but not G and F as the most popular chords. So that's a surprise as well. And then finally, what they looked at was, what would be the most popular chord to come after an E minor? So again, I would have thought an A minor, maybe an A, but what they found was, most popular chord after an E minor was an F, believe it or not, followed by an A minor and a D minor. So this is really interesting, And again, this was not a poll of songwriters, which might have skewed things a little bit. This was an analysis of 1,300 hit songs to find out what the most popular keys are. So again, most popular keys, C, G, and E flat, and the most popular chords, G, F, and C. Very, very interesting. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program, which is 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks with a Small Studio. You can go to 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. My guest today is engineer Wynn Davis, who's worked on so many legacy hard rock acts like Dio, Foreigner, Dokken, Bad Company, and many, many more. Wynn also owns Total Access Recording in Redondo Beach, California. I spoke with Wynn via phone from his home in Los Angeles. And by the way, when you listen to this interview, whenever we refer to Ken, the person we're talking about is Ken Scott, who is the illustrious engineer for the Beatles and David Bowie, among many others, who called Total Access Recording his home for many years. Thanks, Wynn, for being on my podcast today. I really appreciate it. You're one of my favorite engineers.
Thank you, Bobby, and love to do it. Glad to hear from you.
One of the coolest things that you're doing, and I don't know if you're getting a lot of recognition for this, but I love on your Facebook page, the Studio Confessions.
Oh, yeah, that's fun. That's a 30-year, sort of 30-year-plus history of some small uncovered little bits. You know, pretty much kept it to my personal stuff because I've always felt that the studio is sort of a place where my clients should be able to come and remain anonymous and private and not have to worry about what anybody might say. So I try to keep the stuff about sort of my own experiences. But yeah, there's a lot there.
Oh, it's very cool. I'm really enjoying it. So I encourage everybody to go to Total Access Recording on Facebook and look at your Studio Confessions. You don't do it every day. You do it whenever you feel like, right?
That's right. I mean, I'm not real disciplined about it, but I'll be driving along or something, and I'll think of something, or somebody will remind me of something. I'll sit down and try and, talking to you, I wouldn't dignify it as writing, but more like Truman Capote said, right? Typing something up that people can read.
Well, you're much better than you give yourself credit for, I got to tell you. No, you're very good at communicating, so don't feel like you're a slouch at all, because you're really good. I enjoy it.
Oh, thanks. That means a lot coming from you, Bobby.
And speaking of which, I also love your studio, and I love your mixing, and especially, I always watch that Bad Company special on TV that you did that's just sounds so good, and it's so much fun.
Well, actually, I think that you're talking about Foreigner, not Bad Company.
You did a Bad Company too, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. I did a Bad Company one too, but most of the time, people are calling me. The one that seems to get it is this PBS thing that I did for Foreigner in Chicago. I mean, every time it airs, I get like two or three calls from people, and I think, God, really? Because that thing's been on the air for, 4 or 5 years now. And but I've done a lot of that work over the last, for some of these legacy bands, over the last, maybe 10 years. And a lot of live stuff. And it's really been a lot of fun. These guys are such great artists. And, Bad Company and Foreigner, for instance, had 17 top 10 hits. I mean, it's silly, when you start thinking about how many records those guys sold, and between them. And I did a bunch of stuff for Heaven and Hell and Dio live stuff too, when he was still alive.
Yeah.
And those are all, that's really a lot of fun. Thanks for the compliment.
When you're doing that live stuff, so what do you run into that makes it difficult or easier than if you're doing mixing a studio album?
Well, it's the obvious stuff is that depending on the artist, a lot of people are using in-ears now, which is which makes live mixing of a recorded project orders of magnitude easier than it used to be, because there aren't side fills, you know, blaring into every mic on stage, and that helps. But the biggest problem is that the lack of discrete, you know, separation from everything. So you do what you can to create that, and then where it doesn't exist and where you can't do anything about it, the alternative is to use that to your advantage somehow. And I do a lot of different things depending on what's in there and how much and where it's coming from, to use that to sort of help glue the whole thing together.
What I especially like is it sounds like a studio recording, but yet it still feels live, because you seem to have the ability to balance the audience so you still have that live feel, yet it doesn't feel washed out like a lot of, you know, live shows on TV do.
Well, part of what I spend a lot of time on is I do an extensive and painstaking amount of vocal editing, you know, on every open mic that is on stage. So part of what people just can't bring themselves, because it's a little bit, I mean, for anybody who's done it, and you probably know this, Bobby, it's sort of soul crushing work, because yeah, it's so tedious, you know, and it takes a long time to make sure that everything is there, but that all everything else that doesn't need to be there is out. And if you can do that, and you do that editing on your favorite digital workstation, it takes a long time, but the result is that when you get in there and you start mixing it, you push the band up, and then you start to push the vocals up, it doesn't change everything immediately, because that's usually what happens, is that you can spend a lot of time trying to get the balances right, and then as soon as you start to push the vocal up, everything goes to hell in a handbasket, because between every word, you know, you have either the monitors blaring or the drum set leaking in or the guys walking around stage and phasing across the whole, you know, soundscape. So that seems to help me a lot. That's what I do. And I think that at the end, every percent that you can, limit that sort of undesirable leakage, the fixed leakage is actually okay. You know, the stuff that's leaking and it's not moving around the stage, mm-hmm, and doesn't have people moving in front of the microphones, those are sort of helpful. But the rest of it, it's really helpful to get rid of it if you can.
So when you're mixing a show like that, when do you put in the audience? Do you put it in at the end? Do you have the audience in right from the beginning? Which way do you do it?
I put it in at the end. I put it in at the end, and because I feel like I want to be pushed to generate the excitement in the mix, and not let myself, because I get emotionally involved in it too. I mean, I listen to the crowd, and you know, it gets me all hyped up. I mean, go, yeah, that's great, you know. So I usually just have the audience mics and the house mics muted for the entire process of trying to get the song and the band's balances and everything, you know, sort of cranking along the way it's supposed to. And then I start to add the audience and try and get the responses in that seem appropriate, you know, including stuff where there's audience participation, where there's clapping, where there's cheering. I think at the end, it feels to me like you've got to justify that with a great mix, you know, so it sounds like something that everybody would be excited about, and then add that in at the end. That's how I do it.
Are you mixing the picture?
Sometimes, yeah, a lot, yeah. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you don't always have the picture. It's a funny thing, because you don't always have a picture of the audience and their response, you know, because I don't have the, you know, offline cuts. I just have, you know, whatever the online cuts are. And
yeah, but
so I sometimes if I've got the picture, then that's fun. But I don't always watch the picture the whole time either. I usually at the near the end of the process, I start bringing the picture and the audience which can be a problem too, because once I mix the whole show and realize that I have the guys on the wrong side.
Yeah.
For the picture. And we know.
Yeah.
Fortunately, there are a couple of tools out there that fix that rather quickly, but it is disorienting as a mixer when you all of a sudden everything's flipped around.
Yeah, right. But yeah. What I particularly like, though, like when there's a lot of guys that will mix the picture, the guitar player will come on screen and all of a sudden they'll goose the guitar. Or, you know, whatever instrument seems to be on screen gets louder. And I understand why they do that, but it doesn't make for a good mix. And what I like about what you're doing is it just sounds good no matter who's on picture, or if you take the picture away, it just sounds great. Doesn't matter.
I think that's important. I mean, that's just careful mixing, Bobby, I think. I mean, you know, it's just, you don't want people to feel like, you know, they're suddenly, you know, come out of nowhere, and you don't want them to feel like they're yanked off the stage with a shepherd's hook. You know, you want it to feel natural, just like the guys do when they're up there. And I think having, you know, played some guitar and been on stage a little bit myself when I was younger, much, much younger, I have at least a sense of what that feels like when you step on a pedal or something and it doesn't just, you know, jump out of the band in some kind of unnatural way, but it just sort of gets on top a little bit. I think that's just being responsive to what you're seeing and hearing and being careful about that. But I know what you're saying. I watched that, I'll get like crucified for this, but I watched that Stone thing a couple of years ago where they had, I think Bob Clearmountain did it. And do you remember that?
That's exactly what I'm thinking of, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, do you remember that? And yeah. I was in the theater and I remember thinking, what in the hell is going on with
yeah.
this? And I understood what they were doing because I actually tried that in surround myself once a long time ago with this guy from Austria who had this idea that you could take a mic around the stage and literally focus it on whoever was on camera and it would sort of move in the sound field. And I think that's what they were trying to do, but it completely disoriented me when I watched that movie. I actually really loved the movie. It was so cool.
Yeah.
And it was such a great thing overall, but some of the audio stuff we did was disorienting, I would say, for me anyway.
You know, the bad part about that too is I've watched it on television since, and the stereo, it sounded like it was just a fold down, and it really didn't work as a result. You know, it's really unbalanced. And knowing Bob, he probably did a separate mix, but that doesn't always mean, you know, it will make it to, you know, television. So,
absolutely. And you never do know, you know, I mean, a lot of times, you know, you hand this stuff in and somebody else does some sort of fold down. So that brings us to another subject entirely, which is when you're doing a multi-channel mixing for picture and DVD, and you know it's going to be released as a stereo product as well, it's very, very important to make sure that you hand in something that is satisfying to you and your clients in stereo before you let somebody just, you know, fold it down, because
yeah.
it can produce an amazing discrepancy between what really felt great in multi-channel format and what just doesn't seem to work at all in a two-channel format.
Yeah. So all the TV that you're doing then, it's all starting in multi-channel, I assume?
You know, I've done it both ways. It really depends on what the primary destination is, actually. If it is something that's going to be, you know, primarily marketed as a DVD, I'll start in multi-channel. And if my client tells me, well, we're going to put this out as a live CD, and we might do it, we might, you know, use this video and release it as a DVD later, I'll do the stereo mixes, and then I'll start, you know, converting it to multi-channel. I mean, it's a similar process either way, but obviously it's sort of like, you know, the only thing that I can compare it to is the way that Ken used to tell me about how they would do these mono mixes, right? And they'd spend a lot of time doing the mono mixes of the Beatles stuff, and they'd get it exactly the way they wanted it. And then when they did the multi-track stuff, you know, they'd sort of adapt it as best they could. And I think that's sort of, you know, how it works in the modern commercial sense of, you have something that your clients ask you for, and you make sure that you get, you know, their primary target satisfied first, and then do the best you can with what's left over.
You mentioned before about the DAW of your choice, and I know you work in Pro Tools. Was it a difficult transition for you to go from analog? Because you're a big analog guy and you have an analog studio that's great. Was it a big transition for you to go to the digital world or the partial digital world?
Well, I started working in reel-to-reel digital in the late 80s. So, I mean, I was early on the digital side. I actually think that but as far as the digital audio workstation thing is concerned, yes, I came to it pretty much kicking and screaming. I wish I had been a little bit more pliable at the time, because I think it would have been good as a business decision earlier on. But the audio side of it was so bad for a long time that it was impossible for me to embrace it in the way that I wanted to. But I think things have actually gotten quite a bit better in the workstation world. And, you know, there are a lot of people who've worked really hard to try to get us into the sample rates and bit depths. And, you know, as the technology has allowed for much, much higher processing values and stuff like that, it's gotten quite a bit better, but it was a hard transition. Now, it's almost impossible to imagine doing a record anymore in the way we used to make them. Is even able to conceptualize of what that was like. I mean, there's only a few people who will even attempt it. And, you know, it's always sort of a novelty, you know, because I don't think people really understand. I mean, I have young bands in here all the time who come in and go, hey, man, let's do it analog. And they say, okay, well, here's a couple things you need to know. I mean, you're going to have to play it right all the way through.
Yeah, I went through that last year. Might have been the year before. I did a record that was all analog, and I didn't come to you, to your studio, because it was the artist that had the friend with the studio, so I was kind of forced to go there. And she also insisted that it was all analog. And I hated every minute of working with tape. It's great working through a nice big analog console, that's fine, but boy, working with tape is just awful. And you know, it was the things that nobody thinks about. Okay, the band is hot, it's a 4-minute song, you only have 3 minutes and 50 seconds of tape left. Okay, so then you roll it off, and then you go get another reel, and you roll it back on, and it's 15 minutes later, and the band is, you know, they're cold now. And, you know, again, it's, oh, that was a great take, let's do another one. Oh, wait a second, there's no place to put that. You know, that's just those things that we take for granted.
Well, you're absolutely right, Bobby. People forget. And, I know you work in analog. You came up in analog. But people forget what it took to make tapes, to make records like that. For instance, that scenario that you just described actually requires that you have two machines fully aligned, ready to go, and that you just change the Elko, and you have another reel, you know, you have another reel sitting there ready to go. And if you're at the end of a reel, you know, you just change the Elko and then press record, and you're, and that takes, you know, 30 seconds. But if you don't have those sorts of techniques and workflow things in place, and it's hard to remember all of them if you haven't done them for a long time, then, you know, it, you're right. It just slows everybody down to a trickle, and everything that you were supposed to gain by having an analog experience is lost through the process of just trying to keep up with rolling everything back, aligning the tape machines, making sure you've got all the biasing right, you know. That's your, you know, it just goes on and on and on. People just don't understand it, I don't think. I don't think people understood how those records actually got made. It was very long and tedious process. And the fact that so many great records got made is a testament to how great those artists really were.
And you know what? It's not that it sounds that much better. I find people are so nostalgic for a sound that they can't remember.
You know? Yeah. Well, they do hear it, though, Bobby. You know, that's the thing. I mean, the emotional punch contained in some of those records is undeniable, but I don't know that it all has to do with the medium that it was recorded on.
Yeah.
I mean, that's certainly... But, you know, you're listening to a CD, you know, Ken described it to me once, and I thought it was really sort of clever, a clever thing. It's sort of like looking at Lawrence of Arabia on a DVD. I mean, you know, it was an amazing, beautifully shot movie on film, and when you see it, it's on film. It's just unbelievable how gorgeous it is. And when you watch it on DVD, it's also really gorgeous, but it's not quite as gorgeous, but it's really, it's still the same movie, and it's, and once you forget about the fact that, you know, you're looking at a impression of film on a digitized, you know, impression of film, you still get lost in the story, and it's still a great film. So the people, what you're talking about is people listening to stuff on CDs and records that were made in analog, but they never actually heard them that way. And I think you're right. People, the biggest part of it is people forget how long it takes to make an analog record and how great you have to be actually to get a take.
Yeah.
That is, you know, that's something that I've talked about with, you know, the musicians in our generation that's really being, that's sort of being lost, the ability to do an amazing take head to tail.
You know, I agree with you. There is really good and bad things that I see. The good thing is everybody grows up playing with click tracks and drum machines and loops. So, it, you know, they're good at that. The bad thing is they're so used to punching in, or not punching into, copy and pasting, that there's no idea of a performance over the whole song. You find that?
Yeah, and a performance is more than just an execution of a well-executed, you know, sectional parts of the song. It is an emotional momentum thing, and all you have to do to prove that is to listen to bands like the Stones and the Who and stuff like that. I mean, I think that I did this with somebody not too long ago, like Honky Tonk Woman, I think is like 20 beats a minute faster at the end than it is at the beginning.
Yeah
it's incredible how, but it's a momentum performance that, and so all that stuff that we love and that has all that emotional content gets lost if you are never asked to, okay, prepare yourself to come in and perform the song in a way that is, that has nothing to do with, like you said, cut, copy and pasting, taking this take, come making a composite, you know. I mean, we've always made composites. That's always been part of the work that we do. I mean, all the way back to Elvis. But the way that it's being done today is many orders of magnitude different, in my opinion, than the way it was done in the past. Even though some people really got crazy with, I've had a forest of little pieces of tape hanging from my speaker socket with certain engineers and producers that I can think of, you know, where they're cutting in, you know, tom beats and snare drum fills and, but for the most part, you know, that's something that I think that kids and younger musicians and younger bands, I think they want that, Bobby. That's why they're asking for the analog experience. They want that experience of, but they just don't really realize what that takes, what's entailed in actually getting to that point. Yeah. I think
you're right, Wynn. Here's a question for you. So when you're mixing, you have a nice big console, nice big analog console. How much are you doing in the box? Are you using plugins? Are you submixing in the box?
It's an entirely hybrid world now for me. I mean, I like to sum a lot of stuff through the console. I like to use faders to balance levels. I use a whole slew of different sorts of hardware inserts in Pro Tools so that I can send stuff straight out and have the analog hardware actually as a plug-in in Pro Tools. I use inserts on the console. It really depends a lot on, because most of the work I do now, and I don't know, I think this must be true for everybody, but I'm not sure, but most of the work I do now is unattended by the artist.
Yeah.
I'm sending them the work, and they are commenting it from wherever they are on the road or in the world, or, you know, and then I'm going back to, you know, two or three songs. And so that sort of workflow in the world that we live in today requires a very, very high degree of repeatability. And you just can't beat the in-the-box part of mixing for that. So I try to limit how much stuff that, I've sort of adapted a little bit of the CLA approach to, I have a whole bunch of stuff that I leave set all the time, and I use it all the time just the way that it is. I don't, you know, try and do a lot of recalls and stuff over, you know, a whole bunch of different gear, because, you know, I have, you know, four 1176s, and I have a bunch of different, stereo compressors that I use for different things. And what I try and do is, you know, go to those. And if I do need to change one or two things, I try and limit it to things where the note-taking can be to a minimum.
Yeah.
And the cool thing about the audio workstation is there's so many models of this stuff now that one of the recall techniques that I've employed is to take the model of the plugin, insert it on the channel, set it up the way that I have the analog piece set up, and then make a note. This is the recall for the 1176.
Oh, that's brilliant.
Yeah.
Yeah, so in other words, all it is, it's your...
It's a picture of, yeah. It's, you know, somebody's already done all the work of making a real pretty picture of with all the control stuff in there. So, you know, I just set it up the way that mine was set up, and then I make a note on the track that that this is where how the piece was set up when I had it inserted on that.
That's brilliant.
In that channel or whatever. Yeah.
Brilliant.
I think the hybrid mixing thing for me is really a great way to go. And I do it all the time and I love it. And for all of the things that we could, you know, bemoan about, you know, workstation, workflow and stuff for the kind of stuff that I'm doing these days, which is a lot of mixing, you know, it's a lifesaver. I mean, it's great for the artist and it's great for me. I think George Matzenberg, you know, put it really great when he said, anything that we're losing in this technology is made up for by being able to take something right as far as you can possibly take it, then close it up and come back to it 2 days later or 2 years later and start exactly where you were that second that you closed it up.
Yeah.
And refine it again. I think that for the kind of work that we do, that's invaluable.
Yeah, absolutely. You've done so many great rock records, all your stuff with Ronnie Dio, classic records. Tell me about the guitar sounds, because you always get great guitar sounds. What's your secret?
You know, I mean, honestly, I don't have a secret. It's my secret is trying to work with great guitar players. I mean, that's the truth, Bobby. I mean, I wish I had something to say about. I mean, obviously, there's a few things one should avoid if possible. You know, creating problems when none exist, but. Aside from that, trying to make sure that the guys that you're working for are great players. I mean, that makes us all look really good. And I have to give most of the credit to the guys that I've been working with all these years who are just, you know, great guitar players and know what they're doing and know what they want to hear. Because when they... Most of these guitar players have invested an enormous amount of themselves and their energy into finding a sound. So I've always felt my job is just not to get in the way of that, not to try and reinvent that, not try to, you know, be instructive with them, but try to capture what they've already invested a lot of their emotional selves in creating. And because that'll allow them to perform, and that sort of it is my secret is not getting in the way. Maybe that would be the best way to say it is to create. The studio is a really hard place to get excited about playing in. From, you know, people assume that, you know, you come into a studio and it's really great. Hey, I'm making my record. But it doesn't have any of the feedback that you're used to. You're not in the room with you. With your amp a lot of times. Sometimes you're wearing headphones. There's so much stuff that's alien. You don't have any feedback from the audience. There's no energy in there other than what you create yourself. So the engineer's job in those circumstances is to do everything possible to make it fun and make the experience as comfortable for those guys as it can possibly be, so that they actually have a chance of expressing what they came in to express. Because it's not that easy to get excited about playing in a room, no matter how without anybody there, no matter how exciting it might seem at the beginning. Once you get set up and you're in there and you're by yourself and you're in that fishbowl, it's just sort of intimidating, and it's not that much. It's not automatically fun.
Yeah, but you're a minimalist when it comes to miking. If I remember, I know there's a lot of guys that will set up, you know, a dozen microphones trying to get the guitar sound, and you get it with one mic, right?
Yeah, one or two, yeah, usually. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's the way that I mic the guitar. Usually, I get down there and try and listen to what's going on and try and hear it like the mic. And I put the mic where I think the guitar sounds best. And usually try and be a little off axis from, you know, right on the cone, so it's not too bright. Try and, you know, basically try and allow the microphone to do whatever work it can. And, you know, there's a lot of different microphones out there, and it just depends on what you're listening to. I mean, if you know what a 57 sounds like, if you know what a Royer sounds like, if you know what a 87 sounds like, you know, if you know your microphones, you'll put whatever you feel might help compensate a little bit for what might be problematic coming out of the cabinet and for the proximity that you might be in for the guitar. But that's just me. I mean, a lot of people do it a lot of different ways. You know, and you're right. I mean, I know I've seen people in here with, and I've done some of this myself with a little lab box and splitting out, you know, two or three different heads into different cabinets and, you know, trying to combine those. But it's funny. A lot of times it always just comes back to, you know, that one head and that one cabinet that just is putting it all together just the way that the artist wants to hear it and the way that it fits in the track. So,
yeah, I know the records that we grew up with, the sounds on those were fabulous, and they didn't have the ability to do a lot of the things that we could do today. That was very simple, you know, the way they did everything, and it sounded great. So, you know,
I know. Did you know what, Bobby? That's so true. I listened to Band of Gypsies the other day, and man, the guitar sound on that record is so good.
Yeah.
You can't believe how good it is.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, he's playing great as well, but when you listen to the recorded sound on that record, I just think, wow, man,
yeah.
that is burning. I mean, it's so big and, you know, it's awesome. I'm sure that was one mic.
Couple final questions for you. What's it like owning a commercial studio today? There's not many people that do it, and you've been successful for quite a while. So what's that like? That must be one of those things where I'm not going to say it's a struggle, but it's one of those things that you have to think about two things. You have to think about your career and then the studio as well, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, my career is what it is. The studio, basically, Bobby, honestly, and this may be just some sort of wild old guy fantasy at this point, but I still believe that it's worth having a studio that, like this one, which is not one of your marquee landmark studios of LA. You know, it's not Ocean Way or Capitol or the Village, but it is a place that's actually a studio that was designed with acoustic principles and built at a time when you could still build a place like this and run it. And it's still big enough for a whole band to come in and track and for that experience to be possible, even though there's less and less of that going on. I still am sort of holding out for a day when the value of that returns and people will go, gosh, you know, I wish there was a place that we could go that wasn't, you know, so expensive that we couldn't afford it.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the only reason that this place is still here, because it's a very large footprint for what most of the work that I'm doing nowadays. I mean, we still do have bands that come in, and a lot of people love it that there's a piano here and that there's a B3 here and that there's, you know, there are lots of instruments and amps and stuff, but really it was built to track bands, you know, to have a whole group of people in here playing together and making something happen. And, you know, the fact that we don't do as much of that as we used to is really sort of sad for me, but I'd like to keep it going as long as I can to make sure that if somebody wants to do that, we're here. And it's something that is inside the budget range of some of the younger and newer artists and the kids coming up.
Well, it's definitely a great place. I enjoyed my time there, I got to say. It was everything sounded great. There's everything you needed there. Enough place for isolation, everything. It was just a great experience. And I know I'm not the only one that has said this over the years. So It's a great thing.
Yeah, well, we've been fortunate to have people like you and Ken Scott and Joe McGrath and Mixer Man and, you know, a lot of great engineers. Michael Wagner started here back in the 80s. We worked with a lot of great engineers and producers, and we're grateful to all of them for everything that they contributed to making this place survive this long.
Last question for you. What's the best piece of business advice, music business advice, that you received from someone or that perhaps you've learned over the years?
From the studio and engineer standpoint, it is to have the largest skill set that you can accumulate and that you can assemble for yourself. Because in order to make a living in audio today, you need to know how to do a lot of different stuff. It's good to have a vocabulary and all of the sort of current workstation technologies. It's good to have some vocabulary in all of the different kinds of musical genres and the way that they're created today. And it's important to be able to understand the post world because, you know, a lot of the work that is available to us now is in post. One of my most important clients right now is a consistent, voiceover client that does ads, every week, and it helps make the continuing existence of the studio possible. And we do film mixing. We do you pretty much have to do everything today. It's the days of specializing in being the guy who gets a great guitar sound, I think, is over. If you want to make a living and have a whole career in audio or have a studio, you have to be able to do a lot of different things. And that's what I've learned. And I think that's part of the only reason I'm still working is that, you just have to be able to get in there and realize that there's some joy to be had just in the fact that we're doing something in our chosen field, and it's not always some star-studded event. Sometimes it's just simple stuff. And if you love it, you'll be all right.
That's a great piece of advice. Wynn, thank you so much for being with me today. This was great. I knew it was going to be. You're always so much fun to talk to. And I hope we can do it again.
Thanks, Bobby. Really appreciate it, man.
To find out more about Wynn and Total Access Recording, go to his Facebook page at facebook.com/total.access.recording. That's Facebook, total.access.recording. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino, who's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab. Or you can go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter and for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski, and I'll see you next time.